can come in. Well done. Good, welcome back, folks. Good, so when we were thinking about what to talk about this evening, Subhadramati had a suggestion, which is to do with actually with next week. So I'll just tell you what's happening next week. We are welcoming back to the LBC three brand new order members. Actually, they're already back in London. They came back a few weeks ago, but we haven't formally welcomed them. So there's Aryajit, Dharmajit, and Sangajit. There's a little poster with three very shiny, wise-looking men in blue robes that you'll see in the sort of bookshop area. And they're going to be formally welcomed back. So Subhadramati thought that it would be good this week for us to explore what ordination is, why ordination. So that's what I've called it. I've called it why ordination. Anyway, that's the title. But to be honest, I don't quite know what I'm going to talk about. So we'll see what unfolds. And it might be that I sort of get onto the theme of ordination. I hope we do. You might need to nudge me in the right direction if Subhadramati will nudge me if I stray too far into other terrain. Maitre Bandhu, though, was just talking, wasn't he, about if we want more from life, if we want to grow, then we have to take risks. If we want to grow, we have to take risks. And I guess one of the things in my own life, if you'll indulge me, I'll just tell you a little bit about my own life and what motivated me to, in a way, take a risk to coming to Buddhism in the first place. One of the sort of strands in my own life from a very early age, from the time I was, as far as I can remember, really, but probably I was about 5, 6 or something, maybe even earlier. From a very early age, I've had this sense, and I don't think I'm unique, of wanting more, sensing that there's more to life. And I don't just mean more toys, although I did mean that as well. I meant a whole other world. I meant a whole other dimension to life. And as a wee little boy, I was very entranced by magic. You know, I guess Harry Potter hadn't been invented then, but if he had been, I would have been a Harry Potter fan as a wee boy. I asked for a magic set for my sixth. I think it was Christmas. I'm from a Hindu family, so we didn't celebrate Christmas, but I wanted a present, and so I asked, you know, Father Christmas in the traditional way, burning things and whatever, to get me a magic set. And I also told my parents, just in case they had any influence on the matter. And I can remember waking up very, very excitedly, very, very early on Christmas morning. And yes, in my room there was this big parcel. It seemed like a big, big parcel anyway. It was probably only so big, all wrapped up. And I tore open the paper, and inside, lo and behold, there was a magic set. And first thing I took out was the wand. It was a sort of bendy wand, actually. You could sort of—I don't know why it had a bendy aspect to it. And immediately I thought, right, my sister, who's older than me, she was going to turn into a rabbit or something, a frog, probably. And I tried very hard to do some magic. And of course, it didn't quite work like that. It came with a whole instruction manual. And gradually, as the day wore on, it dawned on me that it was a sort of box of tricks, none of which I really wanted, actually. I wasn't interested. So there was this yearning for something more, and I guess a bit of a disappointment. I had this boyish imagination that would try and nevertheless create magic. The girl over the road, Katie, was slightly older than me. She was Paul's older sister. And for some reason, she became associated with witchcraft in my mind. I and Tony were, I guess we were wizards battling the forces of darkness as personified by Katie. There was this kind of thing that, you know, I wasn't 12 by then, I was still very young. And alchemy, I would try and turn coal, lumps of coal into diamonds. I don't know if you've ever tried to do that. I kind of had a sense at some age, I don't know how old, if you applied enough heat and pressure, the coal would turn to diamond. And then, I don't know what we planned to do then, but a lot of time was spent creating heat and pressure to little avail. Moving on, when I was a little... this sort of wonder, this sense of wonder and wanting more did continue. And then when I was 11, my dad died, and he died very suddenly and quickly, of a heart attack. And I, as well as being... very, very shocked and upset, and my life was turned upside down. When I sort of got used to the idea that he'd died, I was interested in trying to contact him and see if I could, you know, prove to myself that there was something beyond death. And as a 11, 12, 12-year-old, I don't know, I started sort of trying to do that in my own way. And I felt I had some response. I felt that I was in communication with him for a number of years, actually, which to my own child's imagination showed me that death wasn't the end. Actually, I think even as an adult, I believe that death isn't the end, and I believe that something of our consciousness carries on. I can remember in my early teens reading Hermann Hesse. Have you read The Glass Bead Game? Has anybody read The Glass Bead Game? I think it's his most magnificent novel. And in that novel, so I must have been about 14 or 15, I don't know, maybe 16. In that novel, he talks of... it's set in the future, in a mythical future. And he talks of a place... which is like a monastery, I guess, Castalia. And in it, the monks are devoted to, they're questing for truth. But by truth, there's a spiritual truth that they're questing for. It's not separate, this truth, from beauty. And it's not separate from friendship. It's not separate from love, in the sense of deep, deep sense of friendship. And they have rituals in this mythical space. And their rituals involve playing with symbols called the Glass Bead Game. And these symbols represent, or they're multivalent. So each symbol, and Hesse doesn't actually describe how, but each symbol has many, many meanings. So what he talks about is, for example, the language of music is written in, well, a particular notation, musical notation, or at least Western music is. Then you've got... language with its alphabet, you've got mathematics with its own symbol set and its own meanings, you've got aesthetic language and so on. And he imagines that somehow these people of the future have found a symbol set where any one symbol can have, at the same time, a musical meaning, a mathematical meaning, a poetic meaning, an aesthetic meaning, a meaning towards truth in a philosophical sense, a conceptual meaning, and all these things. And these wizards, I guess, of Castalia do rituals playing with these symbols, creating symphonies that have meanings on all these levels, all at the same time. And they live in friendship and brotherhood. And I can remember thinking that, I can remember thinking at the time, I was very, very moved by this novel. I've not really read it since, although I've read passages of it. I can remember vividly thinking that if only there was an order like that in this world, I would give my life to it. And I was probably only 16. So moving on, I sort of started getting interested in Buddhism and eventually came across this particular order and movement, the Triratna. Well, we weren't called Triratna then, but that's what we are, the Triratna Buddhist Order and the Triratna Buddhist Movement. And by then I was a bit more worldly wise in my 20s and was really cynical about any organized religion. I didn't want to join any organized club or religion. So I would come to classes like this here at the LBC, but be really wary of talking to anybody, particularly if they were wearing one of these, in case they got me. So I would be sort of interested and aloof at the same time for about a year. And then I went on a retreat, and it was somebody, probably it wasn't Maitre Bandhu, but it was somebody like Maitre Bandhu, making announcements about the winter retreat, just like he's done now. And actually, he was leading that retreat that I went on, just like he is this Christmas. I thought, oh no, that's not for me. That was my immediate response, it's not for me. He means those really serious people who are meditating every day, not getting drunk every other night, not partying and not... I had a kind of worldly career and life, I guess. Not that nostalgic for that. He doesn't mean me. So that went on for a number of months, probably, until it was quite close to Christmas, and then I thought, well, I'm going to give it a go. I had nothing else to do. Hindus don't celebrate Christmas, as I've already gone into. And I made provisional contingency plans for New Year, just in case the retreat was awful. I also drove there, so I knew that I could drive back at any point. I got there in the dark on a very, very foggy night. I booked for the whole 10 days because I thought, well, in for a penny, in for a pound. So I'd sort of made a provisional kind of commitment, but I was ready to leave. As I got out of the car, I met a man. The first person I saw had pink hair and pink stripy trousers and tattoos everywhere. And I very, very nearly just got back in the car. Very, very, very nearly got right back in. It's just that I'd driven quite a way, and it was foggy. It was really, really foggy. You couldn't see more than a few yards in front of you. So I thought, okay, well, I'll spend the night, and then tomorrow morning I'll have breakfast, and then. And of course, I stayed for the whole 10 days, and it transformed my life. I want to sort of move on to kind of extrapolating from my own experience to something a bit more, perhaps a bit more relevant and general. Because everybody who comes to the Buddhist Center has their own journey, has their own story as to why they, you know, press that buzzer on the red door to come in here. But I dare say that there are some common themes, and I hope that what I say resonates with you at least to some degree. So the first theme that I think often brings people to the Buddhist Center is this sense that there ought to be something more to life. At least if they come for Buddhism. Sometimes people come for meditation, and I guess that you come for meditation just wanting a bit of peace and a bit of relief from stress. But if you venture into a Buddhism class, then you probably have a sense that there is something more on offer, and it's of some worth to you. There's probably this sense of maybe it's quite specific, maybe it's rather vague and inchoate. But there's probably a sense that, yeah, there's more. That sense of there's more might come from this sort of sense of wonder I tried to touch on, you know, that I had as a child, because most children have some sort of sense of wonder, but we tend to lose it, don't we, in our teens or whatever. It might be through a sense of wonder. It might be through some sort of heightened experience that you've had, whether that's chemically induced or natural. There might be, also connected, though, a sense of dissatisfaction. It might be that life hasn't quite lived up to the promises that you thought it ought to deliver. A sense of it doesn't quite work. It doesn't quite work. For me, that dissatisfaction actually did dawn on me in the months, years following my father's death. I can remember as a kid thinking, how do adults, like the grown-ups, after my father's death, how do they carry on sort of living, going about their daily lives as if we're not going to die? How can you talk about anything else? How can you say what's on telly tonight? Or where shall I go on holiday? Or, I mean, it wasn't that I was a completely angst-ridden existentialist 12-year-old. I also, you know, wanted to go on holiday and things. But there was this strand of, this doesn't work. This whole thing just does not work. I had a very strong sense, as quite an early age, that I couldn't have put it into words, but looking back, it was this sense that all the things that people normally try and pursue in life, the house, the car, the mortgage, the partner, the family, the holidays, the career, wealth, status, beauty, power, all of those things, none of them work, because you can drop dead at any moment. And if you do that, none of that meant anything. None of that meant anything. It was inchoate. It wasn't as articulate as that. But I had that sense that life won't work at its own level. Coupled with this sense that actually, a sense of wonder that there's something more. So I think that's one reason that you might find, well, a sort of double reason that you might find yourself exploring the Dharma, exploring Buddhism. Both the sense of something more, coupled with a sense that life on its own level, on its own terms, this mundane, samsaric existence is ultimately unsatisfactory. I think there's another reason or set of reasons which I too felt, in particularly in my student years, in my teens. I became for a while involved in student politics, actively in left-wing politics, and there was this strong sense of wanting to right the wrongs of the world, a strong sense of injustice at the horrors of the world. Apartheid was in full flow, I guess, in when I was a student, and there was a strong sense that we as students could do something to affect justice in South Africa. I don't know if we actually did, although we all, I don't know, disinvested from Barclays Bank because Barclays was investing in South Africa. We would cause havoc in supermarkets. It's a whole other world. I'll tell you anyway. You know, you'd fill your trolley up with. I don't recommend this, by the way. It's not quite a Buddhist thing to do. Anyway, you'd fill your trolley up in Tesco's with goods from South Africa, and you'd get them checked out. And then, in mock surprise, you'd look at a pack of oranges or something and say, "My goodness, these are from South Africa. I couldn't possibly." And then walk out, causing disruption. And then, perhaps more positively, but probably not very effectively, at the university bop, which was fortnightly disco, we always ended with "Free Nelson Mandela." That was our sort of anthem. That was sort of one example of just wanting to try and make a difference in the world. This sort of wanting to make a difference in the world and trying to, I don't know, affect positive change, be part of a solution rather than part of the problem, can also bring people to Buddhism. Particularly, maybe not so much in this country, but particularly in India, many of the Buddhists in India, and the millions of them, have come to Buddhism because they want social change, because they want social change against a caste system. They want to break free of the caste system with its terrible, terrible injustices and cruelty. And here, I guess, we're also aware of the, I don't know, the sordid mess that we can make of the world. Perhaps we're aware that Buddhism might have something to say about that. And perhaps it's one of the reasons that we come to Buddhism, or certainly it could be one of the reasons why we choose to go further and practice further. I'll try and address that reason a little bit later in my talk. But both these reasons are, I think, really essential. However you arrive at the Dharma, if you want to deepen your practice, then you will have to find your own motivations, and broadly, they may fit into these two kind of areas. One is that you want more from your life, and you have a sense that the Dharma can do that, and you want more for the world. You want to try and make the world a better place, and you have a sense that the Dharma might help you do that. So there you go. There's this transformation of self, and there's this transformation of world. And for me, Buddhism had to, well, any kind of religion or philosophy or anything that was real had truth in it, because I did explore other things. I explored, I don't know, existentialist philosophy. I studied physics, looking for truth in science. But what I felt was that anything that had real meaning had to address both the personal and the universal. So physics tended to address the universal. It told you there were these laws of nature, these laws of that governed matter and energy, and they're beautiful laws that can explain so many things in a wondrous way. But it doesn't have anything to say about the personal. It doesn't have anything to say about how do you find meaning in the face of death. It doesn't. Physics won't tell you that. My physics teacher at school was very, very clear about that. She was, she knew of my interest in physics, and then she said, "But if you want real meaning, it'll have to be religion," she said. She was a Christian, I think, but she didn't want to impose that necessarily on them. And I guess something like existentialist philosophy, for me, did try and address the personal. But it wasn't universal enough. It didn't then have anything to say about the world as a whole. It did talk about the human condition, but in rather a bleak way, without much. I did go through a phase where I thought, I'd just try and emulate Sartre or Camus and have sit in lots of cafes looking miserable. With a notebook, of course. Writing existentialist poetry. But I never quite managed it for very long. I think any true kind of path has to address both the personal and the universal, and the Dharma really does do that. It really does do that. And the Dharma feels to me, well, it's deeper than Buddhism. We call it Buddhism, don't we? We call it Buddhism, but the Dharma is the name for the truth. It's the way things are. And Buddhism is a set of teachings pointing to that truth. But in a way, Buddhism doesn't have a monopoly on truth. The truth is everywhere. And fundamentally, what the Dharma is saying is that we're suffering largely through our own making. Not completely. As soon as we've got a human body, or a body at all, there's going to be a degree of suffering, a degree of pain, as well as pleasure, I guess. There will at times be a degree of pain, and there will be death of the body. So as soon as you've got a body, there's going to be some degree of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. But what the Dharma is saying is that a large part of the unsatisfactoriness, injustice, pain in the world is caused by human behaviour, the human heart and mind, and it's not necessary. It's needless. It's not necessary. And you only have to look at the news briefly, don't you? Syria and the Middle East, Iraq. I guess it's not even just limited, is it, to the Middle East, any country you like. I've been following a little bit the American election debates and things. And I just think, there's so much kind of ignorance that will lead to more suffering. Anywhere you look on a large scale, be it environmental issue or the wars or the famines, there's sort of needless suffering. And of course what Buddhism says is that all our needless mind-made suffering comes down to a delusion, it comes down to ignorance, it comes down to something that we've got profoundly wrong. It's like we've got it so wrong that we're not even aware that we're ignorant. We're looking through the telescope the wrong way round, and we're not even aware that we're doing it. We've got it so, so wrong. And not only have we got it wrong, most people around us have got it wrong. And so we share this delusion, and we reinforce it in each other. And it feels like common sense. It feels like we're completely right when we're very, very wrong. And I'm not going to be able to go into the delusion very much, but briefly, the sort of fundamental delusion is that there's a real me in here, or a real you in you, a real self, and a real world that we're in, a real objectively existing world that we're in, out there, independent of my observations. There's a real independent world that's, as it were, fixed and solid. And in here, there's a real being, a real self called Jnanavacha, who inhabits that real world. And then, as soon as I believe that, and all my senses seem to confirm it, as soon as I buy into that delusion, not just at a conscious level, but at a instinctive, primal level, I buy into that delusion, all of us do. As soon as I do that, I want to try and manipulate that real world so that it suits the real me. I try and manipulate my world in a way that fulfills the real me. And I have hopes and expectations of that real world. And I spend my life pursuing fulfillment through that manipulative strategy. All the greed and the hatred in the world is people trying to manipulate their world so that it gives them some more satisfaction. Everybody wants to be fulfilled. They go about it sometimes in the most perverse ways that causes them and others more pain. But everybody's trying to manipulate their world. And Buddhism's saying that the whole game is completely flawed because self is ultimately a construct. It's not a thing. There isn't a self, a fixed and separate me. And the world is a construct partly made by mind, at least partly made by mind. Self is partly made by mind, and the world is partly made by mind. And mind, whatever that is, isn't real either. So there you go. So that's quite a thing to understand. Even if we can understand it intellectually, which isn't that straightforward, it's quite another matter to see it in your own experience, directly in your own experience. It's quite another matter. And the whole path of the Dharma is to allow us to see the truth of that. It's said that when we see the truth of that in our own experience, not just by nodding assent to Jnanavacha as he sits here, when you see it in your own experience, there's said to be a falling away of any sense of holding on to an identity, to a me, and any sense of wanting the world to, as it were, fit that identity. A falling away of grasping, of clinging. And when that happens, a tremendous energy is released. A tremendous energy is released, which is it's the energy of freedom. It's the energy of creativity. That's how it's expressed sometimes. And above all, it's the energy of love and connectedness, an energy which an awareness which realizes that you never were a separate entity from the rest of the universe, that there was never any real boundary. This skin, this boundary that we take as so real, is just a very, very superficial surface reality. That consciousness was never, never bounded by skin, by form. It was never bounded in that way. Never, never was. And the other sort of realization that's said to happen is that consciousness exists everywhere, in everything. It's not, sometimes we think that we're a body, like we're a material body, and that somewhere in this little skull, in this few inches of head, there's consciousness somewhere in that brain. Buddhism has it the other way around and says that everything is, it would be more accurate. It's still a metaphor, so you mustn't take this literally, but it would be more accurate to say that actually everything is awareness, and awareness can manifest as matter, as form. And we are awareness made flesh, if you like. And everything else is awareness taking some form. So that's a lovely kind of idea, but a deep insight would be more than an idea. It would be a realization. It would be a realization. I was recently on a solitary retreat. I was at Vajrasana for 3 weeks on a solitary in one of the huts there. It's very lovely to do a solitary. I recommend it if you've been meditating for, I don't know, 6 months or so, and you want to do a solitary. Vajrasana is a nice place to do it because you're not in a forest in the middle of nowhere. You know, you're not going to be It's Suffolk. Nothing happens in Suffolk. That's not quite true, and apologies if you hail from Suffolk. Anyway, one of the books I was reading, I took some Dharma books, but I also took a couple of other books. I was reading a biography of Cezanne, actually, and in Cezanne's biography, you really get this sense of a man questing for something more and living from truth. All his questing going into painting. But painting in a way that wasn't just about some sort of hobby. It was about a way to really see the truth of reality. In his paintings, you get a sense of that reality shimmering in the form of his figures, his apples, his still lives, his whatever. Anyway, I was reading biography of Cezanne, and then I was reading another little book. I just picked up this very, very slim book called On Having No Head by Douglas Harding. And it's a memoir. It's a tiny little book. It's a memoir of a man called Douglas Harding, who's no longer alive. He was writing in the 1960s. He was born in the early part of the 20th century. And he seems to, at, I don't know, a young age, maybe in his 20s, maybe in his 30s, had some sort of insight into the nature of reality. He had it while walking in the Himalayas, although he later talks about how it could have happened anywhere. And his insight seems to have been a realization that consciousness wasn't bound up in the head, that actually awareness was infinite. Consciousness, awareness is infinite. What he did was he momentarily seemed to stop identifying with form. And he described it as losing his head, because so much of our identity, our sense of me, is often sort of located spatially somewhere around here. Sometimes it's here, of course, and elsewhere. But he felt that this experience was like having no head. And he went on to try and develop a whole journey, a whole path of practice called The Headless Way. Anyway, reading this book, I momentarily got it. I too lost my head momentarily. But what was most moving wasn't just seeing that, yes, this was true. What was most moving was just reading a little bit about him. And it turned out that he lived in Suffolk. And there I was in Suffolk. He lived in Lowestoft. And he was writing in the 1960s when Bhante was probably founding this order and movement. And he was desperately searching for some sort of teaching that matched the experience that he'd had. He wanted that, you know, he wanted that mirrored back to him. And he said the only place he could find it was Zen Buddhism. And I guess in the 60s, Zen Buddhism was probably the only form of Buddhism that was, well, that he came across anyway in Suffolk. And he got very, very excited about Zen Buddhism. But what was more touching was how he talked about how lonely it was. He said that he tried to describe his experience and share his experience with everybody he knew. He said, by the time you read this book, thousands of people I've tried to communicate this to, and almost none of them get it. Even if they have some sort of fleeting glimpse of what he's getting at, they dismiss it as irrelevant, as some sort of altered perception that has no real meaning or value. And what he also says, well, he says it's quite lonely. It's quite lonely. And then he also says that these experiences, these altered states of perception where you see the truth, they're quite easy. He says that's not really the difficult thing. The difficult thing is then transforming your life, these are my words, but his sort of sentiment, transforming your life according to these visions, these glimpses, living by them. And he says that that will be the journey of a lifetime. And the really sad thing is that he seemed to be largely alone on that journey for him. He seemed to be largely alone. Very, very touching, because in the 60s, of course, you know, there's no internet, there's no real way of publicising things. So in the last chapter of this book, he says, look, if you have an experience like this, contact, I think there's a woman's name, I can't remember her name, let's call her Mary. She lives in Suffolk on this number, and she'll try and talk to you. Very, very touching, isn't it? Very, very touching. And he said, look, there are other people who will understand. It's not easy to find them. He then starts to talk about this awareness that opens up, this infinite awareness that opens up, which he also calls the void, because there's no substance into it. He starts to talk about it in theistic terms, so he talks about it as God, as touching God. And of course, Buddhism wouldn't use that language, but I completely recognise what he was trying to communicate. And I felt a poignancy of 50 years later, sitting in a solitary retreat in Suffolk, having a glimpse of what he glimpsed, knowing that I was much more fortunate than him in that I'm part of a Sangha. I'm part of a Sangha. So maybe that starts to bring me on to the order and joining the order. And I haven't got very long to talk about it. But there's something about, if you are going to quest for truth, it will shake up your common sense perceptions of reality. It will shake up everything you know, everything you know. It will turn everything on its head. Everything will be upside down. It is the most radical thing you can ever, ever do, this quest for truth, particularly if you are fortunate enough to glimpse it. It's such a turning around that even the Buddha hesitated before communicating it. He thought that he might not be able to ever communicate it to anybody. Fortunately, he did. He tried and he did. He managed to communicate it. And we're the direct, well, indirect descendants of his communication of the Dharma. If you do want to embark on this, it's very difficult to do it alone. That's why we have a Sangha. That's why we have a Sangha. In the Triratna Buddhist Order, and there are lots of other Sanghas, you don't have to join this one. You don't have to join any Sangha. I'm just arguing for why you might want to get more involved in a community. Because remember, I was really wary of this organized religion stuff. And I would rather, at the age of 29, done it on my own. I kind of thought, I want to learn from them, and I don't need them. You know, I'll do it on my own. If you want to do it on your own, well, of course you're welcome, aren't you, to try. It's just very, very difficult. The Buddha did. The Buddha managed it. The Buddha was an extraordinarily gifted spiritual man even before his enlightenment. In Triratna, what we try and do is we create conditions for each other where it's easier to be questing for truth, treading this path. In particular, the order is an order of men and women who have vowed to quest for truth for the rest of their lives and for lifetimes to come, if that's what it takes. They've vowed to dedicate their lives to in pursuit of this ideal of enlightenment. It's very much like Hesse's order in the Glass Bead Game. Fortunately, our order isn't a monastic order, and it's not limited just to men. There's an ordination for men and for women that's an equal ordination. And you don't have to be a monk or a nun, although you can be if you want to be. It's in a way, it's a more accessible, relevant kind of order than Hesse imagined in his novel, The Grand Speed Game. But there are echoes of his vision in our questing for, in our ideals for not just truth, but also for beauty and for friendship. It's an order of men and women who are putting those ideals at the centre of their life. That doesn't mean that they don't have houses or cars or jobs, but they're not living for those things. What you live for shapes you, determines the sort of person you become. And if you live for an ideal that is transcendent, then you will ultimately, if you carry on doing that, become transcendent, at least in terms of consciousness. The Buddha had an enlightened consciousness and a human body, in a human body, an infinite consciousness in a finite form. And the form was mortal. The consciousness had transcended not just time, but space and all other ways of knowing. And that's possible. That's possible for us. That's possible for everybody here in this room. What's more, it's a universal truth. It's not that you have to be a Buddhist. You have to be a follower of the truth. Buddhism offers you a very, very well articulated journey, path, tools, techniques, support. But actually the truth is everywhere. Consciousness is always trying to break free of the limited confines that our ideas place on it. It's only our ignorance that keeps us small. Consciousness is always trying to break free. So I meet people who have never meditated, never practiced Buddhism, who have had some sort of glimpse. Douglas Harding had some sort of glimpse. It's just that Buddhism says that you don't have to wait for those random glimpses. You can systematically cultivate a higher, more rich, more expansive mind that can ultimately lead you to, transcendence of all limitations. So the order is a collection of people, men and women all over the world. We're not in every country, but there's about over 2,000 order members now, questing for this. They're doing it in relation to each other, because friendship is an essential aspect of the path. So far you might think, I've been arguing for the need for an order because it's supportive, and it is supportive. If you're going to do this, you'll need all the support you can get, because you're workmates, friends, colleagues, family will not be able to understand what you're doing unless they've had a glimpse themselves. So yes, it is supportive, but it's more than supportive. Friendship is one of the natural fruits of the enlightened mind. The enlightened mind reaches out to connect with others. To communicate with others, to help alleviate suffering, the suffering of others. It naturally has that outward going aspect to it. So to think that you can get enlightened or I can get enlightened on our own and then carry on watching, I don't know, your box sets in the privacy of your bedroom, it's sort of contradictory. Do you see what I mean? If you do have a glimpse of enlightenment, you will feel connected with others in a way that is much, much deeper than most of the connections that we normally feel, although it's along the same trajectory. And you will want to try and share the freedom and the joy and the bliss, the creativity that you've experienced, the truth. So friendship in the order is based on that ideal. We're trying to not just each of us move towards the truth, but to help each other share that, and then to reach out to others, because even that's not enough. The order otherwise would be, it could still be like that, but in Hermann Hesse's novel, one of the limitations of their order, as well as being limited to men, to being monastic. One of the other limitations which Hesse himself goes into is that it's rather inward-looking. It's like a closed group that has moved away from the world into its own little ivory tower, this beautiful land of Castalia. And they try and not have anything else to do with the world. Well, the Triratna Buddhist order doesn't believe in that, because the nature of enlightenment is to reach out and help. So this is where, in a way, the transformation of world is really important. If we want to help in the world, and I can't necessarily, none of us can necessarily do everything. We're not going to individually be able to sort out the wars, sort out the famine, sort out the environmental crisis. But we can do something. Each of us can do something. We have to start by working on our own hearts and minds to make that more positive, less selfish, less me-centered. But actually, we can do much more if we work together. So the order is trying to work together to be a force for good in the world. To be a force for good in the world. The enlightenment that the order aspires to is not a self-centered enlightenment. It's not just a freedom for me or you or any one individual. It's a freedom that is dedicated to helping alleviate the suffering of the world. Together, and in the order at the moment, we're 2,000 strong, which is tiny. I mean, it's not even a drop in a drop of an ocean. It's tiny. But it's also had an extraordinary effect on thousands of lives, hundreds of thousands of lives. The Buddha was just one person, and his influence lives on 2,500 years later and has spread across the world. The enlightened mind can have an extraordinary influence. So the order aspires to that. Now, the order is far from perfect. I'm not enlightened. I don't know anybody in the order that is enlightened, not perfectly enlightened, not in the sense of perfectly transformed according to that vision reality. Perfectly transformed. I don't know anybody who's perfectly transformed. I do know people who are much, much more transformed than I am. And I know from my own experience that I have changed. I've grown in the 20-odd years that I've been practicing. It works. It really works. For me, and for many, many other order members, friends in the order, I think most, perhaps, order members would say that it is the most important thing that you can do with your life, to work on transforming your mind, and then together finding others who can do the same, and together trying to be a force for good in the world. Without that, we're reduced to just trying to manipulate the world to suit my needs and wants and petty desires. And that can range from the benign, you know, a bit more shopping, to the outrageously cruel, where, you know, there are wars and cruelty and oppression based on, well, greed and hatred. Based on that root delusion. So when I say that I think this is the most important thing in life, I don't think I can stress it enough. I would go so far as to say that the Dharma is pointing to what life is. What life is. And most of us, most of the time, aren't really living. So that's why some people choose this path, and some of them, choose Triratna. And if you really want to make a commitment to this quest, then you can ask to join the order. At some point, you have a whole training, you know, years of training, which is a whole other talk. It's really exciting, the training. At some point, when you're ready to make a commitment, when you're ready to take those vows to say, yes, I am able to say that this is the most important thing in my life, these ideals of Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, the most important thing, then you're invited to join the order. and you're given a new name, you're initiated. I could talk a lot about initiation. You're initiated into a whole